We're going to talk about, got a request to extend my series on things that they're not what they told you, the various addictive types of sins, and one of the suggestions was gambling. And gambling is not a new problem, but it has become big business. Every state in the United States has some form of legal gambling. Even though Nebraska is actually considered the least addicted to gambling, it still exists. And by the way, the next lowest ones are Alabama, Kentucky, and Utah, are the lower ones. But we got to look at it and say, why does gambling exist? Why is government sponsoring gambling? And of course, we come back to what we have talked about in the past. You look at where the money goes. And gambling exists because of the revenue it brings in. State and local governments raised in 2015, which was the nearest statistic I could find, raised $27.7 billion from major types of gambling. But prior to 1934, gambling didn't exist, at least not legally in the United States. Of course, people gambled, but it wasn't legal, nor did you find the government sponsoring gambling prior to that date. These restraints have all been removed, and states have been allowing gambling to add in revenue to the state. Now you say, well, what happened in 1934? That was the Great Depression. What were they trying to do? They were trying to find new sources of revenue because they weren't getting money because people were out of work. And this is where it started out and it was seen as a quick way of adding money to the budget. When those restraints were removed, states have been allowing gambling to add revenue to the state. And what has happened is that about 2 to 2.5% of most states' budgets, this is on average, get money somewhere from the gambling. Now, some states is higher and some states are lower, but it runs about 2 to 2.5%. What's interesting is when states do this, at first there is a surge. A lot of money comes in. But over time, it dries up. One of the quotes I have, it says, in the short run, most states indeed do raise additional revenues due to the expansion of gambling activities and facilities. However, history shows that in the long run, the growth in state revenues from gambling activities slows or even reverses and declines. In short, the revenue returns deteriorate, and often quickly. This pattern of deterioration may be due to competition from other states for a limited market, in other words, saturation, competition between different forms of gambling, which is called substitution, or other factors. Despite the deterioration, the dynamics often continues as states find new forms of gambling to authorize, open new facilities, impose higher taxes on gambling. The results are short-run yields and longer-run deterioration. In other words, from what I read of that, people get bored of the same type of gambling. And so it starts out big and it falls off. And then they find some new way to encourage it. And it hits big and it drops off again. And so the result is that states end up thinking that adding yet another source of gambling will increase revenue, which it does for a short while, and then dries up. And they almost always add more gambling when there's an economic downturn. You can almost see it as clockwork that when there's a bad economy, one of the first things the states start doing is finding some other way to add gambling because it gives a quick short-term burst to their revenue. From the same source, state-sanctioned legalized gambling has expanded gradually and continuously over the last four decades. All states except Hawaii and Utah collect revenues from one or more forms of gambling, such as lotteries, commercial casinos, racinos, paramutual wagering, American Indian casinos, and some less common forms types of gambling activities. And yet at the same time, gambling is known to have high costs to society. The problems associated with gambling, such as problems pathological gambling, bankruptcy, crime, mental illness, suicide, regulatory costs, family costs, arrest, job loss, divorce, poor health, etc. That's what they mean. When gambling comes in, there's a societal cost, which actually negatively impacts the state's revenues. It becomes an expense. If the benefits of gambling are not clear, and if the costs of gambling are too high, why do state legislatures legalize gambling? As Earl Greenlaw pointed out 20 years ago, the answer is partly that the costs do not appear instantaneously. Partly to those who make the money from gambling do not bear the cost they impose on others. And partly that gambling creates a classical regional prisoner's dilemma problem. Everyone is best off if no one has gambling, but one region can sometimes gain at another expense if it deviates from the agreement to prohibit gambling everywhere. See, one of the problems, he's basically mentioning, we have that problem here. Many times, Nebraska has, had people say, we need to put in casinos because there's casinos across the river in Council Bluffs. That's one of the driving factors. That they see, all this money is going out of state. And they think, well, we'll put casinos here that will bring it in. Say, and yes, the answer is yes, temporarily. But now both of them have it, and they'll both go down. Meanwhile, though, the expenses go up, but that's slower. And people don't notice. As crime and other problems that are associated with gambling rises. So notice we have a short-term drop off and long-term costs that build. But what is gambling? That's sometimes actually hard to define. Gambling is an attempt to get something for nothing without rendering service or exchange of goods. That's what Webster defines it as. A simple definition of gambling would be desiring the possession or possessions of another, the prize. The gambler creates a risk that of losing his own possessions in an attempt through chance or gain the possessions or possession of another with nothing given in exchange. So basically what it is that someone creates this idea to get something for nothing by desiring the possession of someone else. You create a risk, an attempt to gain what somebody else owns without costs and without any benefits given in exchange. Gambling can take on many forms: card games, dice, numbers, betting, slot machines, sports pools, punch cards, bingos for prize or money, raffle tickets, matching, even pitching pennies. Gambling is a matter of kind, not degree. Whether the wager is 50 cents or $50, it's still gambling. If it's done where you're trying to get somebody else's money or possessions of some sort without exchanging services. For instance, there are people who would treat the stock market as a form of gambling. But the stock market actually is a way for people to invest in a business. You're loaning a business some of your money so they can produce goods or services. In exchange, you own a portion of that business. As a business exceeds, the value of your portion of that business increases as well. And that's why successful investors analyze the business they're investing in to make sure they're worth taking part ownership of that business. When it's treated that way, the stock market is not gambling. Yes, there are people who gamble with the stock market, but that's not just like, you know, football is not gambling. But there are people who will use football to gamble with. That's two different things. But why do people gamble? Well, there's a desire to gain wealth quickly. People get impatient with getting ahead through regular work, so they think that, hey, this is a quick burst. I can possibly get a higher economically with just a seemingly small cost. There's a desire for excitement. The risk, the suspense, the hope, the shock of surprises, that entertains a lot of people. And that's part of the drive behind it as well. There's also an instinctive combativeness. There's competition. Who's going to win? Am I going to win over everybody else? In other words, gambling is basically driven by covetousness, greed, laziness, and recklessness. The thrill. And because of that, gambling is also addictive. The North American Foundation for Gambling Addiction helps reports that approximately 2.5% of the U.S. population has some type of gambling issue. That adds up to nearly 10 million people in the United States who are struggling with a gambling habit. Earl Gringos, economics professor at University of Illinois, says the casino industry is heavily dependent on the revenues of psychologically sick people. More than half of a casino's take comes from problem and pathological gamblers. You got to understand that. They prey on those who are compulsively addicted to this form. Now, why do people say it's all right? Well, one of the arguments is oftentimes, and usually when it's brought in, is saying, well, the good's going to come from it. Okay. It's called gaming. But it's not much of a game. Most games of chance return 30 to 50% of every dollar invested. You think about it, is that a game? I got you. Actually, I skipped some slides here. Hold on. I'm just trying to figure out what I did. We're going to have to hold on to that slide. I got a whole section where I missed. Either I got the slides way out of order or we'll find out. But, you know, gambling is oftentimes called games. But most games of chance, like I said, only return 30 to 50% on every dollar invested. And isn't that fun? You get to play a game that's designed to take over half your money. Is that a game? A long time ago, I ran across Dave Olson wrote an article. It was just a wonderful little article. It said, How to Win the Lottery. And it's a true story for anyone it's a gambling lesson. He said, there is a man in Texas City, Church of Christ, named Marlon Reednor. He works for the city of Galveston and oversees the water department. The year the Texas State Lottery commenced in 1991, one of the employees wrote on the whiteboard a little table tracking lottery winnings of employees. Any employee could put their name on the board and to track to see who won the most money. Six people signed up and tracked how many tickets they bought. When they won, they added the money. When they lost, they subtracted the cost of the tickets. Marlon put his name up there too. He bought zero tickets, made $0, and lost $0. And after 10 months of tracking, he won with $0. Finally, a guy who was in the negative by about $400 raced the board in disgust. You would think they would have taught everyone a lesson, but it didn't. They still play, and he still doesn't. He probably has a net worth more than the other five employees combined. A lottery is a tax for foolish people. Take a look at Proverbs 28. Proverbs 28 and verse 20. Proverbs 28, verse 20. A faithful man will abound with blessings, but he who makes haste to be rich will not go unpunished. Remember, that's one of the drives for gambling. It's a quick way of making money, supposedly. But when you try to rush it, you'll end up losing. Sometimes it's argued, well, hey, it's a chance to make your situation better. That's the argument a lot of poor people buy into. Hey, I can put a few dollars down and I won't be poor anymore if I win. In fact, the primary source of gambling income comes from the poor and the moderate income families. More poor people gamble than rich people do. Guess what that should tell you? But God expects us to be stewards of the things He's given us. Take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 4. 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and in verse 2. But it moreover is required of stewards to be that one be found trustworthy. Now, God has given us a lot of things, and here He's talking about the giving of the gospel. But it's true in the general sense as well. We are given our lives. We are given the income that we have. We are given all these abilities that we have. What do we do with them? Are we being good managers of what God has given to us? But think about the fact that gambling is a guaranteed way of losing money. That's what it's designed to do. It's designed to transfer your wealth into the coffers of the casinos or whoever's running the gambling outfit. Yes, every once in a while somebody wins. But the odds are, I didn't write down the recent most odds, but usually the odds are something like you can get struck by lightning four times before you win the lottery. That's the type of odds we're talking about. And yet people will keep going back, and every once in a while they win just enough to whet their taste for it. Meanwhile, they're losing far more than they're winning. In fact, one young man told me, I gamble on Major League Baseball and nothing else. I consistently win, having a 58% winning rate going on 2 years straight. And I pointed out to him, wait a minute, you said you consistently win with a 58% winning rate. That doesn't sound consistent to me. That means that he's winning 58 out of 100 plays, which means he wins more often than he loses, but he still loses 42 out of 100 plays. That's not a consistent win rate. But see, gamblers are hooked on only seeing the wins. See, that's one of the problems with gambling. When a person gets into it, they only look at the wins. They discount all the losses. They tend to ignore the losses as a group. And see, there's a deceptiveness to sin. If I took a coin and flipped it, what are the odds that it comes up heads? Was 50-50. Okay. If I flip it and it comes up heads five times in a row, what are the odds that when I flip the sixth time, it's going to come up heads? Gamblers have a hard time answering that question. Scientists and mathematicians have a very easy time. The answer is 50%. It doesn't matter what the past was. Coins don't keep track of the past. They don't go say, oh, well, I was heads five times. I got to go tails this time. No, you flip a coin and it's 50-50, period. Because the coin doesn't remember the past. Now, while who wins a baseball game is not a mechanical process, this young man was using his knowledge of baseball to improve the odds of deciding who will win. But you know, the fact remains that no one really knows. If we always knew who would win the next game, why bother playing it? The reason game is played is because we know that the best team doesn't always win. In fact, take a look at Ecclesiastes 9. And just some noise, man. I know I typed those slides in, so I'm just positive I got them all out of order. You there, I somehow raced them between upstairs and downstairs. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 11. I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to warriors, nor is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men for ability, for time and chance overtakes them all. The best doesn't always win. Things happen. Chance happens. Good guesses in the past does not mean you'll be successful in the future. Odd makers set the odds so that the organization running the pool wins about 30 to 50 cents on the dollar in the long run. And past success does not change those odds any more than flipping the coin is going to change the odds. Now, one of the other arguments, by the way, he said he's giving up gambling when I started arguing with him. I made those arguments with him. I hope he did. But another argument is, well, good can come of it. And that's why gambling is oftentimes brought in. It'll fund our schools or some other charitable organization. It's supposed to get a portion of the proceeds. That's usually what they do with raffles and stuff like that. Saul justified his disobedience by claiming, well, hey, there's good going to come from it. I'm going to offer it as a sacrifice to God. Take a look at 1 Samuel chapter 15. First Samuel chapter 15 and verse 19. Then the king said to the Gittite, I got 2 Samuel. 1 Samuel 15 and verse 19. Then Saul said to Samuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord and went on the mission on which the Lord had sent me and brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took some of the spoil of sheep and oxen and the choicest things devoted to destruction to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. Samuel said, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices and in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than the sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Just because Saul said, hey, we're going to do something good from this, did not change the fact that he had disobeyed God. Just because somebody claims, hey, this is going to support schools, or this is going to do some type of charity work, it doesn't change the nature of what gambling is. And as Paul pointed out in Romans chapter 3, Romans chapter 3 and in verse 8, and why not say, as we senselessly are reported in some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may come. Their condemnation is just. You cannot get good out of evil. If something is wrong, it doesn't make it right because you claim there's some good that comes from it. A claim of good result doesn't prove it was right in the first place. If such were true, then why not pat the thief on the back when he robs people as long as he spends most of the money on charities? Or his own education? Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7, Matthew chapter 7 and verse 17, he says, so every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. You know, I've had people claim, well, if I win, I'll give 10% to the Lord. But you know what? God doesn't want the money of sinners. In fact, in the Old Testament, in Deuteronomy 23, and in verse 18, he says, you shall not bring the hire of a harlot or the wages of a dog into the house of the Lord your God for any votive offering, for both of these are an abomination to the Lord your God. When people are involved in sin, you can't make it better by saying, hey, I'm going to give part of that sin money to God. It doesn't change the nature of the sin. Now, another argument it often made was just a small amount of money. I've seen that all the time. And it's only a couple dollars that I spend each week. But you know what? Sin doesn't change based on the amount of quantity. Can you imagine someone saying, it was only a little murder? Well, that's kind of extreme, but that's what people are doing. Saying if it's just a small, it's somehow that makes it not so big of a deal. Take a look at Romans chapter 6. Romans chapter 6 and in verse 1. What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin so that grace may increase? May it never be. How shall we who died to sin live in it any longer? And by the way, who determines what a small amount is? See, it comes from an individual's judgment based on his personal feelings. But people don't make good judgments in regards to themselves. In fact, in Jeremiah chapter 10, and in verse 23, it says, I know, Lord, that a man's way is not in himself, nor is it in a man who walks to direct his own steps. We are biased. We don't see everything. When we start making decisions, we often get it wrong. And when people do what they think is right in their own eyes, well, what you end up with is anarchy. Because what you think is right and what I think is right oftentimes is different. But at the end of Judges, the period of the Judges, that's one of the things that's emphasized both at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book. In Judges chapter 21, and in verse 25, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And what do we see in the period of Judges? Cycles where they're getting worse and worse and worse. The sins are getting more grievous, more disgusting, more extensive. But everybody's doing what they think is right. But why exactly is gambling wrong? Well, one of the problems is that God commands us that we are to work for our living. That was part of the punishment, if you would, or consequence of the fall of man. In Genesis chapter 3, and in verse 19, it says, by the sweat of your face, you'll eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you are taken, for you are dust, and to dust you will return. One of the consequences of the sin of man was that man had to work for a living. In the New Testament, we find admonitions repeatedly that people were to work with their own hands. In Ephesians chapter 4, Ephesians 4 and verse 28, he who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with someone who has need. Over in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 11. And to make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business, work with your hands just as we commanded you. In fact, if you don't work, we go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. And in verse 10, Paul says, for even when we were with you, we used to give you this order. If anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. For we hear that some among you are leading an undisciplined life, doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. Now, such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to work in quiet fashion and to eat their own bread. But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary of doing good. We're commanded to work to gain our living. Now, we can do, you know, I've had people argue, well, it says with your own hands. Well, there's other ways you can work. Some of the work is mental work. But we can exchange, we can barter. Like, for instance, in Acts chapter 5 and verse 3 through 4. But Peter said, Ananias, why is this? Has Satan filled your heart, excuse me, to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back some of the price of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not under your control? Why then have you not conceived this deed in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God. Ananias had property. He could own it. He could sell it. He could exchange it for other property. That was his choice. That was perfectly fine. In the example of the talents in Matthew chapter 25. Won't take time to read that, but in Matthew chapter 25, in the parable of talents, one of the things the man with the one talent was told to do, he could have invested it with the bankers. And that was fine. Loan your money so the other people can make profit of it and get profit back from it. That was fine. But see, gamblers are seeking to win without earning or exchange of service. They're trying to get money by sheer chance without any effort on their part. Gambling is also wrong because it's an act of selfishness. See, when you give money to somebody, that makes you feel good about releasing your possessions to somebody else. Now, if I wanted to make a gift, you know, they say, hey, we're going to do good with this. We're going to, you know, go to the schools. Well, if I gave some of my money to the schools, you know, that would make me feel good. And Jesus said in Acts chapter 20 and verse 35, in everything I show you that by working hard in this manner, you must help the weak and remember the words of the Lord Jesus that he himself said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. That's fine. That's wonderful. But see, gambling is not about giving money. Gamblers are not happy about losing their money. That's not what Jesus was talking about. Gambling is also wrong because it violates that golden rule. You know the one that's in Matthew chapter 7, in verse 12? Matthew chapter 7, verse 12. In everything, therefore, treat people the same way you want them to treat you. For this is the law and the prophets. But a gambler seeks for other people to lose while he wins. Because others are willing partners doesn't make it right. Everybody's just putting up their money hoping that they will win and everybody else will lose. That's not treating other people the way you want to be treated. But, you know, really what the problem is gambling's greed. In Proverbs chapter 28, Proverbs 28 and verse 22, it says, a man with an evil eye hastens after wealth and does not know what that want will come upon him. There's that idea again. An evil eye, greed. He hastens after wealth, never stopping to think that he's going to end up in poverty. And if you don't understand that, just about everybody I've ever read about who's ever won the lottery ends up poor again. I don't know anybody who's succeeded them. Because they'll end up spending it again. And the amount that we have in life doesn't define whether we're successful or not. In Luke chapter 12 and verse 15. Then he said to them, beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. Life doesn't get better if you win the lottery. It's not about how much you own. It's about how much you've invested in what Christ wants you to do. Whether you put your treasures in heaven, not in buying lottery tickets. I hope you'll think about these things. If there's anyone here tonight who wishes the prayers of the brethren on the behalf, we leave that possibility open. If there's anyone who wishes to become a child of God, there is no better time than right now to put on Christ. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song that was selected?